One good look at the news reminds us that we have a world that's kind of crazy. You know, you see the constant bombardment of images now from the Middle East and from all over the world, in fact. So we get a picture real quickly that something's terribly wrong in our world. And then if we look a little bit closer and narrow it down, and all the way down from looking at the global scene all the way down to looking in the mirror, we look in the mirror often and we realize, and both physically and deeper than that, there's something just not quite right. Most of us know that we are not perfect. Most of us know that we're filled with all kinds of areas in our lives that are hurting. So what does the Scriptures have to say to that? Is there a place for us to turn? In this morning's story, in the series of stories called, that I've called one-to-one, we're going to explore another one of the stories in the Gospel of John where the search for healing comes to the forefront. How are we healed? And how do we begin the process of finding restoration and healing? And that's our story today. So listen as we hear the story.
Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. Now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here is a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time.
Do you want to get well?
Sir, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me.
Get up, pick up your mat, and walk.
At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed,
"It is a Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat."
The man who made me well said to me,
"Pick up your mat and walk."
"Who is this fellow who told you to pick up and walk?"
The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple.
"See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you."
The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well.
Can you imagine? 38 years. 38 years this man had been laying by that pool. And this pool, if you look in your scriptures, in your Bibles at the story we just read, there was a verse that was not read in the dialogue this morning. There's one particular verse, verse 4, that is sort of parenthetical that most scholars think was added at a later time. It doesn't appear in our earliest manuscripts. And it explains a little bit of the mythology or the idea, the superstition around this pool. This pool that was had various names, and most people believe it's the Pool of Bethesda. This pool supposedly had healing, curative powers, and that from time to time an angel would come down and stir the waters, and when the waters were stirred, the first one into the water would be healed. And here's this man, he says, 38 years have been laying by this pool, crippled. There are all kinds of aspects of this story that are moving and troubling. It's a man whose story grabs your heart because we look at this pathetic situation where this poor man has been there for so long by this pool. And when Jesus comes on the scene, though, he opens up the story and penetrates to the deeper realities. And I want us to look at three areas this morning in the story that I think Jesus points us to that are very important. First of all, it's the essential question. There's an essential question that Jesus poses that this whole story hangs on. And he comes on the scene and here's this man. He's been there for 38 years. Evidently, this pool was surrounded by people who had different maladies. But Jesus goes to the person who has been there the longest, perhaps. 38 years, this crippled man. And Jesus then asks him the question that he asks every one of us. And the essential question he asks is this. Do you want to get well? Do you want to get well? Now, that may sound at some levels almost like a cruel question for Jesus to ask. Here's this poor guy laying there 38 years. He's crippled. And Jesus looks at him and goes, "Do you want to get well?" Now, I think what Jesus is probing here and getting this man to think about, what is it that's kept me from this pool? Now, When we hear that question directed at us, do you want to get well? I think it's an important question for us to wrestle with. Because I've come realized in my own experience how many areas of my life that have just never been healed. There are areas of my life, habits in my life, places in my life that I've never allowed Jesus to fully go in and heal. And so we ask ourselves, why is that? Why would this man be there 38 years? Why would you and I hold on to things for year after year after year? What is it that keeps us from responding to that question? Do you want to be healed? Let me suggest some areas. Now, this is not an exhaustive list. But I just, as I thought through, why in the world do people hold on to stuff? Why do I hold on to my stuff? Why is it that I never quite get to the point of healing? And I want to give you four possible reasons why people don't find healing. The first is what I call identity. For a lot of people, their weakness, their malady, their infirmity is their identity. They don't know how to conceive of themselves apart from that infirmity. I've known people like that. I've met people that had anger and bitterness over some past thing way back in their lives. But one of my dearest friends is this way. He's got a wound that goes all the way back to his childhood between him and his father. And he's wrestled with how to come to the point to get healing. But I think a whole lot of it is I don't think he derives so much energy and passion for life out of the wound that his whole identity has sort of been wrapped up in this woundedness. For some people, their identity is so wrapped up in their woundedness or their malady, that whether it's a physical infirmity or emotional or spiritual, whatever it is, that it is through that malady that they actually get attention. By portraying themselves as being someone with some kind of infirmity, it's what actually gets people to pay attention to them. And they do not know how to conceive of themselves apart from that which is wrong with them. Perhaps this was the problem with this man. We don't know. Perhaps he'd been there his whole life, or for at least these 38 years, and even though he'd never been healed, perhaps he was known throughout the city as the man by the pool. And that was his identity, and that's how people paid attention to him. We don't know. But I'm sure it's true for many people, and perhaps it's true for some of you. Now, the second reason that sometimes we hold on to our stuff is fear. I'm afraid of what might happen to me because my identity is wrapped up in my infirmity or because I've never known anything different. I'm afraid of what might happen to me, even what might be expected of me if I'm healed. I find that particularly true in my own experience about areas of my life. There are certain habits or certain personality, things that sort of flow out of my personality or the way that my life has been formed, and I have some bad habits or I had some, you know, areas of my life that I really know how to get on, but I'm sort of afraid to go there because I had this weird kind of sensation deep in my heart that if God really changes those things, more will be expected of me. Or I don't know where that's going to lead me. And so sometimes I'm afraid of the new me might look like. And perhaps you've harbored some of those kinds of fears as well. What would happen if God touched you deeply in your heart? And even though there's a side of you that longs to be free, there's a side of you that's downright afraid of what that newness might bring. What would I be in a new place? Well, the third thing that perhaps keeps people from responding to that call, do you want to be well, is hopelessness. Maybe you just don't believe anything will ever change. And maybe you've heard stories of other people that God has touched. And maybe you think, oh, God can do that in that person's life, but probably not in mine. And so there's a sense of hopelessness. This man had been there 38 years, and I think his hopelessness was compounded by the penetrating phrase that he utters when Jesus, and he says, no one has been there. I have no one to put me in the pool. Isolated and alone. I have no one to help me. I have no one to help me. 38 years by this pool and no one to help me. No one to help me. So there's a sense of hopelessness that's born out of this isolation, and perhaps it's exactly how you feel in your own struggles. There's no one here that understands what I'm going through. There's no one that really cares. There's no one to help me walk through this. And a sense of hopelessness is born out of just not believing that God can do anything about your situation, and certainly you have no one to walk with you through it. How will I ever be healed? But finally, let me suggest a fourth area that might hinder us from responding positively to the question, do you want to get well? And that is pride. For a lot of us, we don't want to admit our weakness. We don't want to admit that we have a deep need. We would rather present ourselves as being together. You met those people? They have it look like they have it all together? I just operate on the assumption that no one has it all together, even if they look like they have it all together. But we live in a society in America that is designed to try to help us to look like we have it all together, physically, emotionally. And it is our very pride and unwillingness to admit that we have deep need that often keeps us from finding healing. Now, we don't know what all was going on in the life of this particular man, except that the statement that he was alone by the pool and had no one to help him, that he'd been there 38 years and he'd never been able to get into the pool when the supposed the waters were stirred, and he was living out this superstition, 38 years of ailment, of infirmity, 38 years perhaps of being ignored or ridiculed or talked about. Who knows what this man has endured? But Jesus looks at him and says, do you want to get well? And as Jesus speaks into his life, this man finally is confronted with a stark reality. He has a moment here in which Jesus has spoken into his life. This man has spoken into his life. And he says to him, get up and walk. Get up and walk. I've tried to put myself in this man's place. I've laid by this pool for 38 years. I've lived under the superstition that if I could just get in that water when it was stirred, that I would be healed. I've lived there alone with no one that I can call a close enough friend that I could trust to be the one to stand by me in this. And here this person I have never met before, perhaps I heard a rumor or two in the city about this man who's going around teaching and healing. We don't know what this man knows about Jesus. Jesus walks to him and says, get up, take up your mat and walk. What does he do? He responds in obedience and in faith. The greatest act of faith, this guy, he picks up his mat and walks. He picks up his mat and walks. And in responding to Jesus' call, he believes that he can be healed. He obeys what Jesus calls him to do, and in an instant, 38 years of infirmity fall away. They fall away. And he stands up and walks. Well, this story is a glorious and beautiful one, but it takes a dark turn here in the middle of the story. And it's a dark turn that we're going to find that happens in story after story, both the one we'll look at next week and the one 2 weeks from now. And we'll explore it in greater detail as we move through these recurring encounters. But the dark side of the story is the Pharisees who are standing nearby, the Jewish leaders, who see this man now carrying his mat. Now, we do not know if he's identified as one yet. By them as the man by the pool. They may just see this man carrying the mat. But they have what I call the prejudice of power. A prejudice of power. And what do I mean by that? It's very simply this. Because their power in the community is kept alive by the system of rules and regulations, by the system that's there, their position as the teachers of the law, as the instructors of the law, the ones who have control over that, their power is dependent upon people believing that they need them in order to order their lives as the keepers of the law. And so their power is anytime someone steps outside of the rules and regulations that they have laid down, they are their power. This comes into question. So they see this guy, so they immediately say, we can't let anything dilute our power. So they challenge him. It's a Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat. And I love the answer he gives. Well, the man that healed me, you know, the man that made me well, said to me to pick up my mat and walk. Now, you would think at this point, I don't know, maybe I expect more of myself than these guys. And if I'd have been in their place, I may have said the same thing. But if a man walked up to me and said, and I said to him, you shouldn't be carrying your mat, it's the Sabbath. And what he came back to me was, well, the man who healed me told me to do it. My next question might have been to explore the healing. My good, you mean you tell me about this healing? But that is not what they're interested in. You know, they are not excited at all that this man's been healed. It's not on their radar. They don't care that he's been healed. They only care that he's carrying his mat on the Sabbath, that he's breaking the Sabbath law, and in some way deep down inside challenging the power of the law and their leadership, their dispensing or controlling of the way that law is applied. And so the Torah, the very law of God, is being abused, twisted to preserve their power. What a horrible thing. The very law of God, given to sort of reveal to reveal to us the beauty of who God is, the gloriousness of His character, the depth of His holiness and His covenant love, this revelation of the person of God and the calling out of a people to demonstrate His love as a light to the world, this very law in the hands of those now who have twisted it and turned it becomes an abusive instrument to control people and to manipulate others and to sustain their own power. And here's this man who's just been healed, and they cannot even enter into any sort of rejoicing, even an inquiry into what had happened. They only want to know, all right, who is this guy that told you to do this? Who is the one that's challenging our power and challenging the Sabbath laws? Who is this person? It's their only concern. And so the Torah, the very law of God, is being twisted and used to preserve power and to control people. And in the end, it takes them away from God, not toward them. And this leads us to a very important consideration in this whole story, and that's the tyranny of rules and expectations. I think a lot of people miss the healing touch of God because of this tyranny of rules and expectations. And whether it's the law of the Old Testament or a law that we have constructed of our own making, that this is what a good person is like, and these are the expectations of what I should live up to be a good and successful person. Whether it's constructed by the Christian community along the same lines, and maybe from starting from a good place, we're trying to say, what does a good Christian look like? And so we construct a model of that and a list of rules about that. And we start then to do something very deadly. Our shift, when we make the rules and the expectations around those rules, the focus of our attention, our shift goes off of God and onto conformity, so that that which is important to us is not our relationship with God, but are we conforming to those rules and expectations? So the way we even evaluate how we're doing in life is up against this arbitrary standard of what we believe people want us to be or what we're expected to be. And parents, we can hand that down to our kids. And brothers and sisters, we can hand it to each other in the community of faith. And the shift goes away from God and His healing touch and His gracious intervention in our lives to make us new. And it goes on to the rules and expectation. And living on that, it obscures the healing power of God. And how many people are sitting in our churches today, perhaps in this church this morning, that are not healed deep in their soul? Because their eyes aren't turned to God, they're just worried what other people will think about them because they don't feel like they measure up to the rules and the expectations. That is a deadly thing. It was a deadly thing in the day of Jesus. It's a deadly thing in our communities now. That people could be hurting and pain, needing the healing touch of Jesus, but their eyes can't get to Him because they can't get past the feelings of defeat and despair over what other people think about them. You know, almost all of the secular and spiritual alike, almost all the formulas that are given for healing from some addiction or for some deep problem in life begins with what? Admitting that you have the problem. The whole Christian walk that we're going to look in just a moment, that begins with a recognition that we have a need. But if what we direct people's attention to when they feel that need is a sense of rules and expectations that we want them to live up to, a standard that they need to achieve, they'll never get there. Because in our own strength, we can't get there. And we languish in that place of despair and hurt because we can't break free from that tyranny. Men and women, this is serious stuff. These people could not even rejoice in the miracle of this man walking because they were so caught up and have elevated to a level that was just aberrant and destructive, the idea of conformity to that law and the power that they had as leaders to manipulate and control people by making that the issue. Well, I wish this were the only episode in these stories where this issue comes up. But it's going to come up again next week, and it's going to come up again the next week after that. So we're going to have to keep returning to this idea of the clash of who Jesus is and what he offers with that of institutionalized approach to God, a codified approach that says, here's what you ought to live like, go do it. And the power and the structures that we raise around that. So keep your ears and hearts attuned and ask God's Spirit to show you the ways in which that very thing may have crippled you, or by the way that our attitudes toward others have crippled others because we have imposed on them not a sense of the glory and transcendence and healing power of Christ, but a sense of expectations and performance that is keeping them from finding the healing that Jesus offers. So Jesus asks the essential question, do you want to get well? And he probes deeply, and this man responds when he's told to pick up his mat. But there's intervening in this story. There is this prejudice of power that comes when we don't conform to the expectations of the surrounding of those around us. But then Jesus brings this story to a wonderful conclusion by taking to the place of deeper healing. Now, what is this deeper healing? Now, this man has had this interchange between the man was healed. He has this interchange with the Pharisees. They've questioned him about this. He honestly doesn't know the name of the person that did this. He only knows that he's been healed. And that's the man that healed him told him to pick up that mat. These Pharisees continue to pressure him, but Jesus has slipped away into the crowd. But now he comes back and finds this man a second time. And I love what he says to him. See, you're well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. Now, once again, at one level, that could sound an awfully harsh thing for Jesus to have said. See, you're well again. You're walking. Stop sinning, or something worse is going to happen. Well, that's because I think Jesus is asking us all, asking this man and asking us all to look beneath the surface. To look beneath the surface of our lives, because a lot of times our presenting problem, our felt need, as painful and debilitating and difficult as it is not the real issue. There is a deeper healing. Now, Jesus in his compassion has no problem healing this man's infirmity and allowing him to walk again. But Jesus is not satisfied with that. He wants this man to be completely healed, to be deeply healed at the core of his being, so he takes him to someplace deeper. And while Jesus meets our needs on many levels, he wants us to find the deepest healing, the healing of our soul and spirit at the core of who we are, where sin has done its greatest work, when all these other things that we seem to be more taken up with are just manifestations of the deeper, deeper hurt. So Jesus takes him there, looking beneath the surface to find the true and deep healing. And so Jesus takes him a step in the place of finding true healing. He takes him to the place of his sin and the issue of his soul. Stop sinning or something worse may happen to you. He suggests to us in this particular phrase that there's something worse than being crippled, laying by a pool for 38 years. That's what Jesus is saying. There's something worse than that. Now, on the human plane, most of us can conceive a few things worse than that. That my whole life is spent laying by a pool, 38 years crippled by a pool without any friends or family around me to help me, alone, isolated, by yourself, crippled by a pool, 38 years. And Jesus says to this man, there are things worse than that. There are things worse than that. And that is when our souls aren't healed through the gracious touch of Christ. Now, like so many stories in the Gospels, we don't know how it ends. This man goes back and he actually tells the Jews, now that he's talked to Jesus, this is the guy. And that launches a whole new set of confrontations between Jesus and the Pharisees. It's the whole pressure and the confrontation between the two is going to just grow and grow and grow until it finally culminates on the cross. So we don't know what happens to this man. We never hear from him again. We only know this. He couldn't walk, and now he can. And then Jesus probes deeper and said, there's something worse than this. Stop sinning. Find a cure for your soul, the deep pain of your soul. So that leaves us with an interesting question, does it not? It takes us, takes us full circle to where we started. And the question comes back to you and to me, do you want to get well? Do you want to get well? Every one of us have presenting problems. Issues, felt needs that we have. Areas of our life where we feel trapped or wounded or hurt. Some of them are physical maladies. Some of them are emotional maladies. Some of them are relational maladies. Some of them are spiritual in nature. But all of us have some areas of our life where we realize there is hurt and pain. And Jesus asks us to look for Him, not simply to deal with our surface problem, but the deep healing of our soul that comes when we look to Him, His cross. The story is going to lead step by step from this moment to that cross where Jesus will take upon Himself the sins of the world. And the words that were echoed in last week's story in John 3, that God on that cross loved the world so that who would ever believe in Him would not perish but have everlasting life. There is something worse than being by that pool crippled. And Jesus offers to every single one of us a healing deep within our souls. The healing touch of Christ at the very depth of who we are. Jesus, in a verse recorded in Matthew, says, come to me, all you who are burdened, all you who are weary and heavy laden, come to me. And I will give you rest. Men and women, I would suggest to you that the healing touch of Christ is available to every one of us. Every one of us. Look to Him for that healing. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank You for this wonderful story. We thank You for the healing touch of Jesus that's offered. And I pray now that for each one of us, we would honestly and completely face that question, do we want to be healed? Lord, I pray that we would take all that we are burdened with and bring it to You this day. In Jesus' name, amen. Stories like this are best illustrated from real-life stories. And that's what we're going to do this morning. Dear brother from our body is going to come, Mark Cassini. Mark, why don't you come make your way on up. Mark himself has had the opportunity to see Jesus work in his life and to be healed. In order just to get a contemporary, in our immediate context, illustration of the power of a healing Christ, we ask Mark to share a little bit of his story. Mark, come on and share with us.
Danny. Good morning. My name is Mark Cassini. About 7 years ago, I was forced into, by circumstance, into recovery. I had had a 11, or I had a, I was facing 11 years in prison at that point. I had a substantial and heavy-duty morphine addiction due to a motorcycle accident and alcoholism. And I had pretty much destroyed everything in my life. At that point in my life, I was about 46 years old. So, as in the story, you know, sometimes it takes a little longer than others. That man was there for 38 years. I was 46 years old, and I like to say that what was happening to me is I was spiraling down faster than I could lower my standards. And by the time I hit bottom, I was really pretty much of a pitiful excuse of a man. And I entered into recovery. And at that point, I can look back now and see that God's hand was involved in all that kind of situation, setting things up that way. And what He did was He put a man into my life that was a real attraction to me at that time. I had no religious background whatsoever. I was raised in a family that the only time that God was ever mentioned, he had a last name of Dammit that was attached to him. And that was about all the experience I had about God in my life. But this man had a demonstration of a power and a sense of knowing God, and that really impressed me. He had a sense of a real firm foundation of truth that was inside his life. And at the same time, he was living his life as God had requested him to do. He was out evangelizing and talking to people, to guys like me, to broken men that were at the very bottom of their life. And this man demonstrated the sense of God in his life by loving me, by actually opening his heart and his house to me. I mean, I was looking at him and I was wondering who was paying this guy. You know, he told me that he was a Christian, and I thought, you know, they must pay Christians to go talk to guys like me. And then he was in AA, and I thought for sure he must get, you know, some kind of big set of encyclopedias or something for doing, you know, for being a friend to me. And I kept thinking that this guy doesn't know me. You know, he'd go up, get up and go into the kitchen, and I'd look around his house, and I saw all the stuff that I could possibly steal. And I just knew that this guy didn't know me. But he actually knew me better than I knew myself. And I was sitting at the dining room table one night with him, and he said something that was almost exactly what Jesus Christ said. In fact, I believe that Jesus Christ, through this man, spoke to me. And he said, "Mark, look at your life. Look at, this is not a dress rehearsal. This is your real life. This is what you've developed and grew into and have right now. And it's not very pretty. You know, you're facing 11 years in prison. You're a drug addict. You're an alcoholic. But God loves you, and he's reaching out to you, and he's offering you a life that could far surpass anything of your imagination." And he said to me, "Mark, do you want to get well?" And I can't say that I responded immediately to that. It took me about a month. I had every resistance in the world that, like Danny was talking about. You know, what about the starving kids in Asia? What about this? What about that? How could God be in this world with so much trouble and so much hatred and so much violence? You know, the Christians I knew were kind of phony people. And yet this guy was really different. And at one point, now I'm not a very intelligent guy, but I'm okay. I didn't make a lot of stupid choices and did a lot of stupid things and pretty much ruined my life. But when I was looking at my life and I said, okay, this is what I have now. This is what God offers me. I made the intellectual, wise choice and said, okay, I'll go with what God has to say. And what was amazing is that over the next month or two or three, my life drastically changed. You know, stopping drugs and alcohol has a profound effect on your body and on your outlook for life. You know, I stopped waking up in jail, and I stopped doing things, you know, and I started looking at what God was doing in my life. And it was pretty profound. I actually had developed the doctors told me I had hepatitis C and third stage liver disease, but I was on interferon, and I was working my AA program and looking around and thinking that, okay, well, you know, with God on my side, I can manage this life. And I started looking at what all the stuff that I had lost in my life, my wife, my family, my children, and they started entering back into my life slowly. And, you know, and I arranged things and I planned things and I set things up so that I could actually see the kids and they would come and visit me in my recovery house and my wife would actually come and visit me. And I thought everything was going pretty darn good. You know, my plan was going to work. I was going to beat this alcoholism. I was, you know, all set. Now I got God on my side. And I remember driving down 101, and I got the phone call. It was from my doctors. And they said that, the doctor said that, "Mark, the interferon that you're taking is not working. We don't have anything else to offer you." And that based on the rate that the hepatitis has attacked your liver and the liver, the stage that your liver disease is in, we suggest or we think that you have about 2 years left to live. And I pulled over to the side of the road and I started to cry. And I started to look at what was going on in my life. And it seemed like everything, all my hopes, all my dreams, all the things that I really wanted to do and all those plans to see my kids graduate from high school, to see my kids go on and get married and have children, to see that maybe my marriage could get reconciled. All that stuff was being torn from me. And I was just holding on, and then all of a sudden, as these things were just being ripped from my heart, what's amazing is that God has ways of setting stuff up and doing things that were that, you know, setting up the circumstances. And there was a song that was playing on the radio, and I didn't even know I had the radio on. But it was a song that said that when all is said and done and everyone is gone, Lord, you're really all I want. When the best the world has just leaves me feeling lost, Lord, you're all I really want. All that I long for, all that I hope for is just the sense that of you coming near. All that my heart is hungry to and have is just more and one more touch of your loving hand. When all is said and done, Lord, you're all I want. So as I was sitting there and everything was being torn from me, my heart was being emptied. You know, all the stuff that I thought that, you know, God was doing for me, in fact, was being ripped out of my soul and out of my heart. But at the same time, an incredible sense of God was entering into my spirit, into my heart, filling me. A supernatural sense of comfort was coming over me. And as I sat there, I just started to fill up with love. And I just surrendered my life completely to Lord of Jesus Christ. And my life I just sat there and I just started getting filled. It was an incredible sense of what God was doing and wanted to do in my life. And over the next few years, God has done incredible things in my life. He has restored my marriage. In fact, my wife and I just celebrated our 26th wedding anniversary last week. Yeah, it was. My kids, my daughter is going off to UCLA. My other child is going on to Foothill College. And my son has graduated into high school. I got to see that stuff. But more importantly is I got to learn and understand who God is and who he is inside of me. And I'm able to follow the spirit that I have within me as he guides me through things. And he directs me into the next step in my life. I never take the next day as for granted. I have no idea how long I'm going to live. And I don't think any of you do either. But there's an incredible sense of adventure living our lives this way, living my life. I can't imagine living any other possible way. I love to give back. In fact, Ed Woodall had asked me to go to Colombia, to the prisons down there. And I'm not allowed in the prisons up here because of my record, so I had to go all the way down to Colombia to go to the prisons. But it was just an incredible adventure, an incredible, you know, my life is just one adventure after another. And I can't imagine living any other possible way. The way that I was living before when I was laying by that pool, and I was just trapped, surrounded by absolute nothing. No friends, nowhere to go, no desire anymore to live. And God has just opened up incredible opportunities. I'm also part of the R&R program here that meets every Friday night. And that, there's 100 or 150 guys there every Friday night that are exactly like I was. And I look around the church and I see all you saints and my heart desire is to invite every single one of you to come and participate in R&R somehow. Bring Jesus Christ, the Spirit of God that lives in you, to these guys and gals that are totally broken, totally searching, looking and wondering what they're going to do. God brings them to our church, actually to this building, to the room right there, every Friday night. And it's an incredible opportunity that we have to go and love people. You know, some of them are kind of unlovely, but God does an amazing thing there every Friday night. And we as a church body, the church building is being used every Friday night. We as individuals and as the body of Christ have an opportunity to go to R&R and love these guys with the power of Christ. Show them who Jesus Christ is, just like that man did for me. And that's my prayer for all of you, is to come and visit. Come and participate if you have a chance. If you're really blessed, you can go to Columbia to the prisons down there. Then you'll really appreciate the R&R room. Anyways, God bless you. Thank you so much.